This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
See Live Off the Record with Chicago Line is brought to you by Burger King, the Cleveland Clinic, the Digital Transformation Unit, RF Bank and Trust, and WellStar Assurance.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Z Live. I'm Shivago Lang, your host. Just so glad that you could join us here today on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon, policy Wednesday afternoon, a special Wednesday afternoon in the middle of Holy Week. And again, I'm so glad that you could join us today. We have a very special show for you in that the Government and Public Policy Institute has organized through the show for us to hear from some very special guests on a very important topic, in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. It is, to my mind, interesting that we are going to talk about what we're going to talk about, because so much of this week recognized in the Judeo-Christian calendar involves what we're going to talk about, and involves ultimately conquering what we're going to talk about. And so we will hear from some really, really special people on this particular topic. I won't introduce our guests because I have we have others to do that. But if at some point during this show you want to give us a call, the numbers to do so are 323-6232. That's 323-6232 or 325-4316, 325-4316. You can text us on 422-4796. That's 422-4796. So you can WhatsApp me on 439-3043, 439-3043. We have folks also joining us registered through this open online seminar on this Policy Wednesday, and they'll be able to also raise questions. But I have with us today one of the policy fellows at the Government and Public Policy Institute, and she's been on the show several times. She continues to come to share with us some of the things that she's doing, and we have Mrs. Leslie Archer, and she's going to introduce our very special guest today. Leslie?
Hello, good afternoon, beautiful people in Radio Land. Hello, Mr. Lang, my wonderful boss today. I hope you're doing well, and I'm happy to be here as we are going to discuss the tunnel of violence in Bahamian society today with two amazing, amazing, amazing Bahamians. We have Ms. Kappa Bethel and Dr. David Allen, the infamous Dr. David Allen, and the most worthy Kappa Bethel. And I have the privilege of introducing them for you. And I'm so excited. Can you hear it in my voice? I'm very excited. So we're going to, can I start to introduce them now, Mr. Lai?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, great. So about Dr. David Allen, he was born in Nassau, the Bahamas, and he trained in medicine at St. Andrews University in Scotland. He also trained in psychiatry and public health at Harvard. He is U.S. board certified in psychiatry and in addictions, and he has received numerous fellowships, including the Joseph Kennedy Fellowship at the Harvard School of Public Health. He is taught at Yale and in Georgetown, at the Georgetown Medical School. And his psychiatric practice combines spiritual and psychological principles for personal development, mental health, and addiction treatment. Now, Dr. Allen is well known because he started his community work way back in the 1980s when he led the National Task Force on Drugs and developed several drug treatment programs in the Bahamas and in the United States. And he was part of a team, and he led a team actually, that published the first international paper on free race crack cocaine in the Lancet Medical Journal, one of the most prestigious medical journals there is. That paper led to him, it talked about the global pandemic of crack cocaine, and it led to him receiving numerous awards and prizes, and he gained popularity as a speaker. He's a Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Association for Innovative Scientific Research. And in 2009, he started an experimental research project dealing with the fragmentation of family and community from drug and violent crime epidemic in the Bahamas in the 1980s. So dealing with family and community related to drugs and violent crimes in the 1980s, the Family People Helping People Project. And there's a website, familyhelpingpeople.com. It brought group therapy to the inner city and in the prison, supported by a research grant from Templeton World Charity Foundation. And his program shown to decrease depression, anger, violence, revenge, abusive relationships, and increase self-esteem, forgiveness, and gratitude in those who attended the free program for 6 months or more. So he also published from the findings from his group therapy program that led to him engaging in international speaking, in international speaking arrangements as a keynote address. And he also published a book, Examining Social Identities and Diversity Issues in Group Therapy, in 2000 with Routledge. He has numerous scientific papers. He is chairman of the Ministry of National Security Advisory Council on Crime, and he was also a member of the Prerogative of Mercy Committee and have served on the Public Defenders Board of the Bahamas. Dr. Allen hosts a weekly TV program, People Helping People, which airs on JCN Channel 214 on Wednesdays and Fridays at 9 p.m. He has authored numerous books dealing with the issues of psychotherapy, addiction, and Christian spirituality. So that is an impressive resume from Dr. Allen. And now, the Keva Bethel, not our first CB president Keva Bethel, but a Keva Bethel astonishing in her own right. She's an avid researcher with a Bachelor of Science in Biology, minor in Biochem, and a Master's in Public Health. She is inducted into the XI, I hope the XI, XI chapter of Delta Omega Society, the Public Health Honorary Society. And for 10 years, she has actually been director of research for the Family People Helping People Project. So she's been director of research for the project that Dr. David Allen started, offering free group therapy in inner city communities. She's consulted with the Pan American Health Organization and the Ministry of National Security. She has 9 published papers in peer-reviewed academic journals. And she's also copy-edited the books authored by Dr. David Allen and contributed to 3 chapters in 3 textbooks published by InTech London, InTech Open in London, and by Routledge. She's also a children's book author with 2 books published by Trilogy, the publishing house of the Trinity Broadcasting Network. A children's book series is called Adventures with Cohen. So you can definitely check her out. So these are our 2 guests, Mr. Lang, Dr. David Allen, and Ms. Keva Bethel. And we are going to be discussing the Tunnel of Violence today on Policy Wednesdays.
And so therefore, we clearly have individuals steeped in expertise in this area. And I have to tell you, Dr. Allen and Ms. Bethel, that today is a very exciting day for me. Not because I get excited about the topic, but because I have a very keen sense that something has become undone in our community insofar as the way so many of us are relating to each other. And so I want to ask you first, Dr. Allen, to provide us with a perspective on this topic of the Tunnel of Violence. Then we'll hear from Ms. Bethel. And then following upon that, then we'll open up for questions and answers, if that's okay with you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lang. It's always a joy to be with you. I love your lovely smile.
I'm trying to use it even more.
As you know, my journey in this whole field started in 1980, when I came back from, it was Yale, I think, and I kept a journal of number of cases I was seeing in a different type of cocaine. In 82, I saw 32 cases. In 83, it went to 59 cases. In 84, it went to 490 cases. I realized that exponential increase meant that something was happening in the community. It's really important to express. You don't need to do the whole community. Do a microcosm and a sample. So a lot of us get discouraged because we can't do the whole Bahamas, but you can do a lot with what you do have. I went to the Prime Minister and said, Prime Minister, we got a problem. And of course, at that point, he said, David, let's wait and see. But by then, nearly every family was having some type of problem with this strange form of cocaine called crack cocaine. I remember cocaine was one of my major fields when I was doing my work at Harvard. In fact, my first patient was Malcolm X's sister, Jackie. She taught me all about cocaine. In fact, it was a beautiful hot day in Boston. I saw beautiful red, blue, yellow rabbits jumping around my office. Sarang, I wanted to see them myself. I said, Jackie, please help me to see these beautiful rabbits. Little did I know that that was the beginning of the understanding of cocaine psychosis. But I felt in some sense God was preparing me to be aware. I wasn't sure that would happen in my country, but within being back a couple months, I started thinking of this strange thing. I met guys from Freeport who told me, you know, Chris Ferguson, Zabrex, he knows you, Zabrex. Zabrex told me, Doc, it's like having 1,000 orgasms. It's like having Christmas every day. They talked about it so glowingly. And I was puzzled. But then I saw our people falling like flies. One little girl, she was 14, wrote me. Said, Dr. Allen, I've heard about you, but my pusher got all the money I have. I gave him my mummy's china, and now he wants my body. At that point, I went back to the prime minister and said, I feel we've got a big problem. And he then put together a task force and asked me to get a report to him within 1 month, which I was able to do. But in that report, I realized that no papers had been written about this problem of cocaine, because it was known in South America for a while. We had the first national epidemic of that crack cocaine made by Freebase using the baking soda. So what I wanted to do was to get a paper. So I called the White House and heard people with the drug czar working with Ms. Reagan, and they sent him to Nassau. I knew from him from Yale. He said the best thing was to do a prospective study. We got a sample from Nassau, then we got a sample from Bimini. But in Bimini, they said, to understand crack cocaine in Bimini, you can't just study during the day. You have to study the cocaine addicts at 12 o'clock at noon. But a lot of the guys, they say, move at night. They want me to do a sample at 12 midnight. And that was interesting because the cocaine apparently affects your eyes when they're heavy into the drugs. And Bimini had pure cocaine in Chicago, pure stuff. And so these guys, they said, when they took a lot of it, they couldn't see the sun in the day. So they would travel at night. So they call them zombies, cocaine zombies. But what I didn't know, these guys were so smart. They mixed up my sample. They told the guys at 12 midnight to say what I wanted to talk with me like the guys at 12 noon. Then the search was put into the computer. People said, Alan, this don't make sense. I remember Julian Brown, who died when I was leaving Bimini on chalk plane. He said, Dr. Allen, you never get a lick until you come down to Bimini. So my first research was zilch. I felt totally discouraged. I tried hard. People left the Bahamas saying, I'm sorry it's you, but I'm glad it's not me. Your country has a serious problem. By then, families were falling like flies. And the next thing was I got my old professor from Yale, James Jekyll. He came down, and he'd seen a lot of epidemics around the world. He said, after prayer, he said, don't let's do a prospective, because this is an unknown thing. Let's do a retrospective study. Collect all the files of patients who had this type of cocaine from Sunderland and all the files from your program at PMH called Noah's House. We did that, and the end result was the first paper on crack cocaine, which shot up, made a shot around the world. It's interesting, the same time that
recording
paper was
in
done,
progress.
The same time that paper was done, AIDS was also found. And Senator Daniel Moynihan wrote in the New York Times saying, how come no one listens to Alan in the Bahamas? But he said, AIDS came in the same time and AIDS was more sexy than cocaine. So in some sense, we were shut out from a lot of the money which was available. But we started, and every church, every denomination started getting some type of crack cocaine treatment. Sandlands enlarged their program, and we opened a program in Noah's House. But the thing I started to realize that once they were on the stuff, their whole life was shattered. Their family life was gone, and in some sense, particularly women. So crack is the first drug that feminized addiction. When women got into cocaine, I saw them leave their children. Chicago, I saw families with five-year-olds taking care of the 2- and 3-year-olds. It was the hardest thing I saw. But then connected to that was something I discovered that really scared me. I met a few guys who had done some shooting, and I started my program in the prison. And one day in the prison, this guy said, Doc, let me tell you something. You know there's a connection between the gun and cocaine? I said, what do you mean? He said, Doc, when I shot this person in this particular place, and I heard the gun, I heard him squeal, the high I got from that euphoria was the same high I got from cocaine. I kept this very secret the first time I was speaking about it, because that was so scary to me, because it meant that as cocaine went down, I need to do what? Work with the gun. But I didn't know how to do that. So today, I've got crack cocaine down, but the guns are beating me, Chicago. Gun is everywhere. Guys tell me they can get a gun within 5 minutes, any kind of gun they want. And these guns are powerful. Now, this is really sad because Andre Chappelle, Chicago, he's a young man from Life. He was homeless. He got off the drugs with me and worked with me toward the end before he died. His last words to me, Doc, the drug of the young people of Bahamas will not be cocaine anymore. It will be the gun. He was right. We got a gun problem here, which means that we got a severe violence problem. Because this is so important, I want to understand whether there were stages to this problem. And so what I found out was the violence center which I described, it starts right from childhood, where the kid faces some type of abuse. And Kevin's study on the trauma means that a lot of our children are physically, sexually abused and also have severe neglect. In other words, a lot of the guys who shoot the gun or do the murders and stuff, they were victims before they were perpetrated. I really want to stress that, other behaviors. They were victims before they were perpetrators. Hey, do you want to say a word about that?
Sure. So right on the cusp of the pandemic, we carried out a trauma study on his family, People Helping People project, the participants in there. We tested over 200 participants, and we gave them a test for depression, one for anxiety, one to measure post-traumatic stress disorder, and we also gave them something called the ACE questionnaire. That's Adverse Childhood Experiences Questionnaire. And this ACE questionnaire, it asks you 10 questions about your life before the age of 18 years. And if you can answer yes to 4 or more of those questions, that means that you have a significant ACE score. And the people that came up with this in the 1990s, it was an effort between the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and Kaiser Permanente. Their names were Felitti and Anda. And what they said is if you have a significant ACE score, you're at an increased risk for physiological and psychological issues in your later adult or later teen life. So what we did is we wanted to see the correlation between if our participants in the group therapy program, if they had significant ACE scores, meaning they had traumatic childhood experiences, were they then at risk for psychological and physiological illnesses at their present adult life? And the long and short of it was that, yes, they were. There's a lot of them with a significant trauma in childhood also presented with issues, psychological or physiological, as adults.
So once the kid is traumatized as a child, they then experience what I call the shame effect. Shame is S, self, H, hatred aimed at me. When a child is seriously hurt in childhood, they start to have a negative view of themselves. This fragmentation then makes them have what I call an abandonment complex, where they feel abandoned, they feel rejected, and they feel humiliated. Abandoned, I don't have what it takes. Rejected, no one really loves me. Humiliation, I'm a failure. In the community, they call this being dissed. The men would say, I'm dissed. Now, once they're dissed and they feel abandoned, rejected, and humiliated, what happens is that they enter the shame core where they get shamed over and over again. They go to prison, they come out, they can't get a job. Sometimes the girls don't like them. Sometimes the family reject them. So they get more shame. The problem is once they're shamed 2 or 3 times, the shame stops, and guess what? The anger begins. So once a kid has been shamed 3 or 4 times, was initially abused as a child, they now develop murderous rage. So in other words, they have this powerful shame self, then they develop what I call the killer self. The killer self has, and I worked it out, the killer self has 3 components. Self-absorption, it's all about me. I realized no one likes me in the Bahamas. One guy said, I don't fit in the Bahamas, Doc, okay? I'm like a dad dog being dragged by a car. I don't have any rights here. So in other words, don't ask me to protect anybody. I'm out to get what I can get. So self-absorb. There's no empathy. There's no forgiveness. If you hurt me, I have to do what? Hurt you back. So that self-absorption is the first thing happens when he leaves home and goes to the street. He may be Tom Jones at home going to church with Grammy and Mummy. But when he hits Tom Killer Jones on the street, he's now Killer Jones. He's got a false self-persona which deals with what? Respect and what? Survival. All his ethical training and religious training is put on the side. When he hits the street, he is into what? respect and survival. He's self-absorbed. He gets his self-gratification. How? They use strong alcohol, many times Hennessy. They use cocaine, not crack, them with the powder. They use MDMA and also marijuana. And BD is good. That concoction fires them up in their murderous rage, and they are ready now. And then the next thing is they have a tremendous desire to please anybody who protects them. So what the gangs do now, Ricardo, is they groom young men who have been abused, who may have been in prison once. They give them Nike shoes. They give them clothes. They even help their families. In fact, I found the gang now is the masculine part of the single female family in the marginalized areas. So after grooming a young man for 6 months, helping the family, giving money, some buying a refrigerator, air conditioned, they now give him what? A gun. Ricardo interviewed about 20 guys who got their gun. It's actually a euphoric reaction. They said, "Doctor, when I got my gun for the first time, wow, I felt on top of the world." I said, "What do you mean? With my gun, my shiny friend, when I walk down Bay Street, what anybody think, anything anybody has is now mine." But what else happened? I think of the guys who hurt me, and I make a list. I will get them back. So revenge starts. But that gun almost liberates them. So that self-absorption, self-gratification now goes to what? Total control. Because I have what? I have the gun. I'm in charge of myself. I may die, but I can kill you first. So they become totally empowered. They have a myth of invincibility. The sad thing, it's an illusion. So what happens now, they get to the point where they're ready, they're on the streets, they've seen other guys killed, they're now groomed, so that they're actually doing a job, they have to kill. The first time they kill, they vomit sometime all night. By the third time they tell me, it's like drinking water. That's very sad. But here's the problem. They say, "Doc, everything was going well until somebody hurt me." For example, the common things that lead to the killing, they took my girlfriend. A lot of girls trot with the gangs. And the second thing they did, I had a little car, somebody matched my car. You may have heard some instances where people hit cars and guys got and shot them or beat them. Next thing is, people are stealing this drug thing. They stole my drugs. The other thing is, they are like crash bodies. In other words, the big guys may order a hit for, they say, $5,000. They pay these crash bodies, what, $100, $200. But they die, and they die like flies. Listen to the news of the past. And so they almost say, "Doc, we don't expect to live. I just have to have respect and survival. So I don't expect to live, but guess what? I'll take anybody before they take me." Now, here's the important thing they say. They say that survival in Nassau now depends on what? The friends you keep, which means what? The gang. A guy was killed the other day. He said, "Man, I feel so sorry. I knew him, man. He's part of my program." I said, "Doc, why are you sorry? He was out by himself. You should never go out in Nassau by yourself. You don't take certain jitney routes. You don't go on certain streets. If he did that, Doc, that's his problem. It's a realized, this is a danger zone, war zone." So what happens when they have that thing that fires them, somebody taking their girlfriend or their drug, they go into what I call the tunnel. Now, the tunnel has six components. I'll just go through the few. The first thing is, it usually happens somebody hurts them and they need to get back. So they have cognitive restriction. It's almost like tunnel vision for that person. "You hurt me, I've got to get them." Now, maybe that person was told by their superior, "You got to get them because I groomed you for 6 months. I gave your family money. I gave you Nike clothes. I gave you a gun. So guess what? Now you got to act." So at that point, they're now cognitive restrictions that they must act. If they don't, somebody will do what? Kill them. It's a very hopeless thing. It's surrender respect. So a guy who is now Tom Jones home with Granny and Mummy is now Killer Jones on the street with a persona killer perspective. The second one, they get physiological arousal. How does that happen? They have to get psyched up. They call it being psyched up. They take their ecstasy, they take their Hennessy, they take their cocaine, their MDMA, and their BD, and now get psyched up. So the brain of the killer is different from the brain of the guy sitting at home going to church with Granny. Please hear that, family, because we don't. If you talk to these guys like I do, it's a totally different brain. They would tell you, "Doc, I wasn't me. I was killing me. I am now Joe Blow. I go to church with my Granny." And Granny doesn't know that killer. She may get some of the money, but on the streets, he is now Killer Jones. The third thing happens when the drugs set in, they get emotional numbness. I had a guy who was stabbing a person. And I said, why do you continue stabbing him? He thought he hurt me and I wanted to feel it. But he nearly killed him. Otherwise, he thought I wasn't feeling anything. He was screaming, but I didn't feel anything. Emotional numbness. Now, that's a hell of a thing. The fourth thing is now negative energy. I call that evil. And spell evil backwards is live. The verse I use is Ephesians 4:27. Do not let the sun sit on your anger. What? In order not to give what? The devil a foothold. At a certain point, family, fellow Bahamians, is you play with this anger thing, play with this hurt, it goes down to a certain point. And if your anger hangs around long enough, you then sort of start playing the evil. Everything is destructive. The fifth thing is you get ethical fragmentation. All your moral training from schools, from church, seems to be fragmented. And finally, then you go into a repetitive, destructive behavior. Two things happen. It can be masochistic, where you get hurt, angry at yourself, and you kill yourself. Or it can be sadistic, where you're angry at somebody else, and you kill them. Notice in our country, you'll find that as homicides increase, suicides are also increasing. The same issue to kill somebody, since you're yourself, you're killing yourself. And when a guy kills another guy, he's like a dead man, killing another dead man. It's just hopeless. And that's the tragedy we're facing our little country now. It's like hopelessness leading the hopelessness. The evil violence tunnel, there's no light down there. They first enter, and after they do it once or twice, at the end, it's like they're in the darkness. They live in the darkness.
That narrative is intriguing, enlightening. For someone like me, who many of our listeners may not know, absolutely knows many things about the street, many people on the street than they think because of the environment. You know, I was a teenager in the 80s in Grand Bahama. Need I say more? My brother was one of the featured witnesses during the commission of inquiry. You know, you may have known him. Brother Hearns used to be, his name was Brother Hearns. Went to
Brother Hearns. Did you know Sabrett Finderson? Did you know Sabrett?
Yes. And many of the characters.
Where was Tin City? Tin City in Freeport, because I went down there one night. They took me to Tin City. Where was that?
Well, I don't know about Tin City, but we know about Playboy City and a number of other names. But so much of what you say is relatable to people who have interacted with characters on the street, whether they were addicts or they are engaged in gang violence or those kinds of things. So we're going to take a break now. But when we come back, I want then with yourself and Bethel to delve a little further into this, because I think this is so important. Or if you're a parent or a guardian, or you are somebody working with children, a teacher, any one of us, we need to understand what has been said because it is eye-opening. And so, ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Z Live. I'm Shafaga Lang, your host. I'm here with Dr. David Ali and Skeva Bethel. And we're talking about the tunnel of violence. And we'll be back after this break.
Those we love the most, our children and our grandchildren. I vaccinated my children to protect them. Getting your child immunized can protect them against diseases like polio, measles, whooping cough, and others. So protect your child today by getting them immunized. My grandchildren are vaccinated. You should do the same. Vaccinate your children and your grandchildren and make sure they are safe.
Take advantage of the National Vaccination Catch-Up Campaign, March 25th to April 6th. Visit your nearest clinic weekdays between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. On Saturday, March 25th, visit us at the Red Cross, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And on Saturday, April 1st, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., you'll be at the Mall at Marathon. COVID-19 vaccines are also available at all locations. This message is brought to you by PAHO-WHO, the Ministry of Health and Wellness, and USAID.
Have you taken a look at those investment options yet?
Too busy.
Look at today. Workout, breakfast, drop kids at school, back-to-back meetings, dog from the groomer, nails, and that's all before 12. How come you're so chill?
That's because my money is as busy as you.
At RF, we find the best Bahamian and international investments to keep your money busy so you can spend more time focusing on you. Contact us at rfgroup.com to find out more. RF, money at work.
Get your Carifta tickets. The 50th Carifta Games is coming. April 7th to April 10th. Tickets are on sale now. Online at Carifta50.com or at the Thomas A. Robinson National Stadium, Western Grand Entrance. For more details, email tickets at Carifta50.com or call 605-4051.
My Gateway is the centralized, safe, secure way to access and pay for government services online. Go to mygateway.gov.bs and log in to request a police character certificate, renew your passport or driver's license, and more. Receive emails confirming requests and alerts when documents are ready. You must have a valid government-issued ID in order to collect documents. My Gateway is fast, easy, and convenient. Go to mygateway.gov.bs and register today.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
I'm not afraid to take a stand, take a stand. Everybody, everybody, come take my hand, come take my hand. We'll walk this road together through the storm, whatever weather, cold or warm. Let me know that you're not alone. Holler if you feel like you've been down the same road.
Sent them both. I sent.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Z-Live. I'm Shabbat Wulang, your host. So glad that you could join us here today on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon, policy Wednesday afternoon, where we are talking about the issue of violence with two people quite capable of helping us understand what is happening in our society in respect to violence. We have with us today Dr. David Allen and also Ms. Keva Bethel. And they have undertaken some studies that demonstrate, listen to my folk, that demonstrate that there is a strong link between violence suffered by people in their childhood, whether that's sexual or otherwise, and what they tend to do when they enter their later teens and early adult life. And so when you look at the violence conducted in this country by, in particular, males, aiming males, in their early, and their eight, between 18 and 20-something, murders and that kind of thing, when they go and look at these folks' backgrounds, there is this prevalence of having been themselves victimized by violence. And so the question becomes one of, in recognition of that, how do we maneuver going forward? Ms. Bethel, perhaps you can speak some more to this link and what the implications are.
Okay, so our study, we had like 63% females, 37% males, and They were between the ages, predominantly between 20 to 49 years. And what was interesting too, demographically, more than half of them had some college education or graduated from college. So it shows that trauma has no boundaries. It affects everyone, no matter what socio-demographic background you may hail from. About a third of them were in our program for more than 3 years. So we asked a question on the background questionnaire, how many people do you know who have been killed violently? And 78% of our participants know at least one person who has been killed violently, and 10% knew more than 31. So this illustrates the severity of trauma and violence in our society as a whole. Again, like you said, the perpetrators, they were once victims themselves. They were killed psychologically as children because they would have had to witness this violence in their community. So there's this textbook called The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. And he talks a lot about these ACE studies as well, carried out by Felidi and Ander. And what it says is that as the children mature, they didn't outgrow the effects of their early experiences. As Felidi notes, traumatic experiences are often lost in time and concealed by shame, secrecy, and social taboo. But the study revealed that the impact of trauma pervaded the patient's adult lives.
Shivanga, one example in this study is interesting. In our prison group, a lady who was 22 said, "Dr. Allen, you mean at 10 years old, I watched my brother being murdered in front of me. She was shot. And now, 10 years later, I'm in jail for murder." She asked me, "Are you saying if I had somebody to help me when I was 10 after I saw my brother being killed, I wouldn't be in prison 10 years later?" I said exactly that. So, Shivanga, when somebody is killed, police go for the perpetrator. Ambulance go for the victim. Nobody goes for the children. Nobody goes for the children. But the most dangerous situation, that murder scene is who? The children. Officers have told me they see this child-parent thing over and over. Something happens to the parent, the child grows up and does the same thing. And this lady said, "I saw my brother being killed. Now, 10 years later, I'm in prison for murder as well."
And can you speak to this observation? We know that we see this link between early childhood abuse or early childhood trauma and the violence we are seeing with these young people. Let's start there. What have you? Except this, if you take the male out of the murder statistics of our country in terms of perpetrator, we reduce that by 90%+. But yet many females are also subject to this early childhood trauma, sexual abuse and the like, but they are not visiting violence in the same way. So, or are they? I mean, because the numbers just don't. So can you help us see that, understand that?
I think also a prerequisite, what exactly is the definition of violence that we're operating under for this discussion?
Well, actually the country right now, people are terrified of murder, but you have to also realize armed robberies are also increasing. And of course, abuse and rape, gender violence is also there. They all go as one. My point is in all those situations, look for the abused child. A hurt child is a dangerous adult. A hurt child is a dangerous adult. And we have not done enough to protect our children. And that's been the baseline of our work. We've got to do something to protect these kids. But you're absolutely right. A lot of young men are being destroyed. But what we found, as Kevin would show you, in our teenage program, young men become a very high A score, and then they got low GPAs. Ladies are coming with a high A score, but guess what? They have like 3.8 GPAs. How do you explain that? Ladies were abused or hurt just like the men, but they still score high GPA. The men have the same abuse. They score 1.5. How do you explain that, Ms. Archer?
Do you know, during the break, I actually pulled up the ACE questionnaire, the Adverse Childhood Experience questionnaire, because I wanted to have a look at it, and it is quite... it's quite profound.
What was your score? Did you do the test?
I honestly, I was super curious. It's just profound in how normal going through this, how normal some of these questions are. It's like, did you have a parent swear at you, insult you? Like, these questions seem so customary to this society. Like, I don't. That is what blows my mind. That's what blows my mind.
Did you check your score?
I'm not going to tell you because you already a psychiatrist, psychologist. You're trying to set me up, but all my business out there.
But Doc, that question you asked her and the comment that Leslie's making is really very interesting because, you know, I know the society I grew up in, so. Okay, and I know what it was like to, I know what it's like to have children be beaten with pencil, beaten with drop cord, beaten with stuff like that, right? But in our culture, no one would have in very, except in recent times, referred to that as abuse or violence, right? But so, like, when do we get there? When do we get to, you know what, this ain't love, this ain't discipline, this is violence.
Sir, your earlier question with why the females seem not to fare like the males, I would argue that maybe they do, but we don't focus on it as a society because with the ACE questionnaires, they say not only are you at increased risk for psychological issues, but also physiological issues. So you have people with emphysema, you have people with liver issues, you have people with cancer, diabetes, heart attack, stroke. That's also tied to the trauma experienced as a child. And in our study, we saw that about, I think a third of them said, yes, I regularly abuse alcohol. And another third of them said, yes, I have an issue with substance abuse, that being drugs. We also know in our society is prevalent the heart disease, obesity. Diabetes, obesity, and stroke. So maybe the trauma experienced, the males are translating it with violence, into violence, and the females are trying with physiological issues and presenting, you know, to the clinics like that.
And you know, go on, Mr. Lange.
No, go ahead. You may want to hold it because you're not going to have time to develop it because we have to go to the news break. So when you come back from the news break, we'll address it. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Z Live. I'm Shivago Lang, your host. We're here with Dr. David Allen and Ms. Keva Bethel. We're talking about the tunnel of violence that's inflicting the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. And when we come back from the news break, we'll continue our discussions. We're also here with Mrs. Leslie Archer, Policy Fellow at the Government Public Policy Institute. We'll be back after this break.
Recording. When faced with an illness like cancer, we band together. And we at Cleveland Clinic in Florida have your back. From advanced cancer treatments to extra safety measures at all of our locations, we're with you on this journey. For every infusion and follow-up, for every step of the way, for every care in the world, Cleveland Clinic in Florida. Get the care you need when and where you need it. To learn more or connect with a local representative, visit clevelandclinic.org/Caribbean.
The car?
I ain't march the car. The lady who run into me march the car.
I hope she had insurance.
If she had insurance, she hop out, pull out her phone, pull out the Royal Star Assurance app, and bang, she was on a video call with an RSA rep, sending pictures of her damage, my damage, filing a claim on the spot.
For real? Our insurance have that kind of app?
You gotta go to RSA for that.
Download the RSA app today, or visit rsabahamas.com to submit your claim online. Live chat available weekdays 9 to 5.
My business couldn't survive without my credit card machine from Fidelity. It's fast, convenient, and my clients love it. My sales increased, and I can track my earnings. Get your credit card machine from Fidelity today. Call 356-7764. Fidelity, we're good.
This Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid to take a stand. Take a stand. Everybody, everybody, come take my hand. Come take my hand. We'll walk this road together through the storm, whatever weather.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Z Live. I'm Shibago Lang, your host. I'm so glad that you could join us here today on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM, this Policy Wednesday, where the Government and Public Policy Institute has helped us get two exceptional presenters and experts on the issue of violence to speak to us, share with us their findings, thoughts, and soon recommendations for remedy on this issue of violence in the country. We have with us Dr. David Allen, very well known to all and sundry across this country for the work that he's been doing in this and other spheres for decades now, and Ms. Kevin Betham, also working diligently on these issues, this issue as a researcher. Dr. Allen, on the break, as we were talking, you mentioned the fact that we have a diagnosis of the problem. We have a sense of what these connections are that's driving the issue of violence, whether it is in respect of men or women or males or females in the country, and whether it manifests itself as physical harm or death or some illness or mental challenges that the folks face. And the question then now is, in light of what we know, what do we do? How can we approach this?
After I did a number of papers on the drug itself and how it affected individuals, I realized when I got to places like Camp Row, Baintown, other marginalized areas, that we were just going down and down. Violence and crime had taken over, families were broken up, kids seemed hopeless. And so I got seven women together. They all had lost a child to murder. But they also told me, Dr. Allen, not only did they lose a child to murder, their murderer is on bail and they see them every day. So I said, you mind if I meet with you weekly? This is in 2007. We met weekly, seven of them. They said, we don't want anything to do with psychiatry. Don't call us a psychiatric group. I said, what would you like to call? They said, the family. They gave me the name, the family. What should we talk about? Not psychotherapy. Let's just tell our story. They heard my story of trying to relate to them in Camp Road. And I heard their story of seeing their son's murderer. But within 6 months of survival, that grew from seven people to 60. And it just took off like wildfire. Then I realized that what was happening, yes, there were murders, you know, problems, but our country was traumatized and had gone through kind of losing our kind of zest for living. And what I found was that even though I can't heal the nuclear family, these groups became family. In fact, in the prison, they told me, they call it the free of mind family. Because in that group, they said, they became more free than when they were out of prison. So I realized two men behind bars, one just saw the bars, the other one saw the stars. So I see my work with the family now, which I really want to concentrate at 79 years old, to get that back. I had 30, I only have five now. And I hope to get 30 so within 6 months, because I know it's not the answer. Because when I had revenge elimination going, fewer guys were being killed by revenge elimination. But it has to be worked, and it can be worked. But you need a community to work it in. That's where the family is. So I really feel right now this community project is something that has a lot of hope, which I really want to build, not only in Nassau, but the different islands.
So there is that possibility that guided, directed appropriately, other individuals, communities could start or use the family concept to try to bring about some of that healing, some of that remedy that we need. Is that true?
It's really interesting. I'll give you one example before Kevin gives you more later. This young lady was called Fight. Why was she called Fight? She was only 16, but she only beat men. Why she beat men, boys in school, is because her father abused her and abused her mother and then left. So whenever she fought, she would hit a boy with a chair. She got kicked out of school a number of times, referred to us by the courts. Finally, she met Dr. Deeney Fountain, who was my therapist with the teenagers. When she came to the program, Deeney said, "Fight, you will no longer be called Fight in this program. You're gonna be called Miss Jones. And you're gonna look at my face and see a face smiling at you saying, I love you. You don't need fear anymore. I want you now to sit in the seat of love and realize Miss Deeney loves you. And every time you want to fight, I want you to see my face smiling at you." Fight changed. Miss Jones became an ideal client in our program for almost 2 years. And then she did so well, they agreed to have her back to school. The headmaster was so impressed. He said, "Fight has changed." Although one Friday afternoon, he was looking out of his office and he saw Fight pick up a chair. Oh my gosh, Fight starts again. This guy had pushed her. She grabbed the chair to lick him on his head. But to his surprise, guess what? Fight put the chair down. He ran and said, "Fight, what happened?" He said, "I was going to lick him, you know, but sir, but when I saw I was going to hit him, I saw Miss Deeney's face smiling at me saying, 'Fight, you're Miss Jones. Miss Deeney loves you. And you don't need to fight anymore.'" Fight now has got a job, making money, still seeing Dr. Deeney and doing well. That's beautiful. What changed it? I love you. Zhivago, it's simple. Our kids don't know that they're loved. Let's bless the kids. Tell them they love them. They need that. It's so simple. But Fight is working now. Fight graduated with a good GPA. But Fight was a loser. But Fight is now beautiful. Because of love.
Well, that gives some empowerment to families that, while they may not be part of a program, structured program such as the family has, if in our families, as they are, nuclear or not, we can incorporate this gentleness, this kindness, this grace, this compassion, this empathy, then we could demonstrate this love that could turn around some of those things. You know, Dr. Allen, my son said to me one day, I called him and he said, "Daddy, you know something? You have an aggressive voice." I said, "Yeah."
Wow.
He said, "Yeah, you have an aggressive voice." I said, "Wow." And so I took that to heart because I don't want to have an aggressive voice with my son. You know, but what happens is we have a two-story, and when he's upstairs, he got stuff in his ear, so I'm screaming at him to come down. And so later on, so I made it a point, when I called him, I would go and call him more softly, and over maybe 2 weeks, I said to him, I said, "Is my voice still aggressive?" He said, no. I said, "Let me ask you a question. Is your mother's voice aggressive?" He said, "No, but her voice can't be aggressive." I said, "What do you mean her voice can't be aggressive?" Say, "Because she can't speak that loudly." I said, "Oh, you take that loudness as aggression, right?" And so, but the fact is, that's how he was taking it. So I realized I needed to make an adjustment so that he could see and experience more gentleness in my voice, more kindness and what have you. So I'm saying the opportunity exists in our families to change the way we interact with each other, because I'm telling you, we may not intend to be, but we could be very aggressive without intending to be.
That's a beautiful example. They call me soft, of course. I mean, the guy say, "Now, Doc, I love you, but please, I don't want to be soft like you." So, "Hello, how you doing?" But you know, so what I'm getting at is, us men don't tell men we love them, you know. We don't tell our boys we love them. We tell our girls that. But I'm saying simply, we need to talk about, if you say, "I'm empathic, not soft, but empathic voice, let people know we care." And I'm seeing the results of that. Kevin has some results from our family. Would you like to share them, Kevin?
Okay, sure. So just on the last point that you were making, that came up in our research as well, that children who are not seen and known, they grow into adolescents, and adults that who are not seen and known. So it's very important to recognize and tell a child that you love them, because footprints on fresh cement, they last a lifetime. And people won't remember the way you treat them, but they'll remember the way that you make them feel.
That's important. In other words, Zhivago, a child needs to be seen, they need to be soothed, in order to be safe and become secure. So seen, soothed, that's comforted, safe, then that equals security.
And what you're saying is so true. And I suspect that that is one of the things manifesting in a lot of these intimate relationships we're seeing, because you see this disintegration of relationships, you see these splintering of relationships where one of the partners, very often the female, is saying, you know, I'm not seen, I'm not heard, I don't feel cared for, and that kind of way. And some of it is rooted, some of it is rooted in the parenting.
They want to be soothed,
too, soothed. That's right. That's the caring. That's the caring.
Hey, Shivago, how does a man soothe a kid?
Well, I could only tell you how I do it. No. First of all, when I drop my son in the morning, I can tell you, he comes to me, I go to him, and we say we love you to each other every single time. That's standard. But my son, he gets touched on his, in the back, you know, you rub his head very gently. That's part of it. Or I will ask him to sit down on the side of me, and he will lean his head on my shoulder, and we'll sit there just like that for a while, maybe watching television. So we do a number of things that reflect that kind of affection that I want him to know that I'm not afraid to demonstrate in front of him.
I have a question.
Because Archie is smiling. So Archie, why are you smiling?
My question actually relates to this concept of family. I don't know if the study addressed this, but in terms of the family being seen as the solution, is there a distinguishing factor between a blood family where the trauma is actually happening and you still see this, you have the trauma aspect of this person, but then the safe, soothing other aspect of this person or persons in this family? Or is the health benefit seen when a family structure is created, like maybe a group of strangers, such as the coming together of persons in your group? So you know what I mean? Like, is the...
That's a very good point, Ms. Archer.
Yeah,
Ms. Archer,
that's what I
want to
know.
In my family group, they claim they're closer there than in their own families.
So it's important to have a different family or to see the community as a family and not just house the problem within your home. You know, we tend to say, let's keep it in our home. Whatever suffering we cause, we could fix it ourselves or we could address it. Or if there's violence, I could tend to it. But sometimes you need to step outside and create this other family or become a part of a different type of family.
Absolutely. There's a professor called Bayan from London years ago. He talked about the container effect. That a family has to have a container. So you're not good enough a family by itself. You must have a community container. You must have a church container. You need a nation container. Because we're small, we can develop good containers. The family program is just a container. So I want you to come on a Monday and be contained and be blessed.
What our study showed was that 44% of the participants in the program, they had significant ACE scores. And in particular, two of the questions on the ACE questionnaire ask about physical and sexual abuse. The one that asks, did a parent or other adult in the household often push, grab, slap, or throw something at you or ever hit you so hard that it left marks? We had 44% of our participants that could answer yes to that question. And then the one that asks about sexual abuse, did an adult or person at least 5 years older than you ever touch or fondle you or have you touch their body in a sexual way? We had 23% of our participants that can answer yes to that question. So that's almost a quarter of our participants with sexual abuse, almost half of them with physical abuse. But we also give them something called the Allen Resocialization Scale. And what we found was that 98% of the people in that program, after being in the program for some period of time, scored that they were resocialized. So to answer your question, the replica of the family that he's talking about, his family group program, it does work if you present with all these issues at the beginning and at the end, you can come 98%, that's a 98% success rate. You can come out and say, I am resocialized. I have a different way of thinking.
I'm no longer in an abusive relationship. Isn't that wonderful, Ms. Archer?
That's outstanding, yeah. A 98% success rate.
It's so simple. Just people helping people.
Well, it's simple once you can get there. But the problem now is how to get people there. And so that, like, how do we do that? Because you have the family program. So now we need to get people to a family program like yours and so forth. And that's where I find the challenge is, eh?
I see you in your interview with the NASA Guardian, you said that you feel like the church, and there are some spaces that are doing a good job or that working, but you see an opportunity in education and with mental health professionals to help get the job done. How can education, do you mean like maybe institutionalize your program in the school system education, or do you mean just different?
In fact, we have had programs in the schools before COVID. I had 30 programs.
Wow.
Every place. We had a murder rate going up to 140 in 2015, going higher and higher. But when people started talking about revenge elimination, I remember, one lady, her daughter was killed, and I went to the house. And as I sat there, because I would go to the house where the murder happens in those days, and they were planning the revenge attack. And the lady said, you know, David Allen said, he doesn't want to do revenge, just do forgiveness. She decided, Dr. Allen, I want to learn forgiveness. You can't forgive unless you learn to holler and scream. And because her background, she was all used to screaming. So she'd come every Wednesday, we'll just let her scream for sometime 10 minutes, missing her daughter. But when she got it, she said, now I can forgive. She started forgiveness in our family group around 2017. And I can follow, the murder rate started to come down.
Mm-hmm.
Came down because what? People were now dealing with revenge elimination. Before that, whole families in a group of fighting. I can get you back because your family killed my family, my daughter. And it got terrible. But now guess what? After COVID, we're starting again. Last year, 40% of the killings were revenge. So Bahamians are practicing capital punishment. Did you follow that? Capital punishment.
Dr. Allen, Ms. Bethel, isn't it given what we know about this early childhood trauma and its link to violence later on, is it useful to maybe do some of these tests? It's the that you administered to the group earlier, like in the schools at some point where maybe you could pick up some of this earlier.
The thing is, it's not just to give them a test, you know, it's to form a relationship, because people will circle. Remember when he spoke at the beginning of the show about trying to collect data in Bimini, how they would intentionally mix them up, because if you don't have a relationship, people will tell you what they think you want to hear. So in research, it's very important to develop a relationship, and especially with psychological test skills, because these questions ask a lot of like intimate things, you know, about being touched or fondled or having a parent go to prison. Like, they're going to circle anything because they don't know who you are. They don't know what you're going to do with this data. So I don't know if you remember earlier about how I made sure to say, like, I think about a third of our participants, they were in the family group process for like 1 to 3 years. So they felt very reliable. Well, it's called the family. So they felt that we were like family. We were family. So, hey, okay, they're just asking us some questions, you know, to get to know us better, to see where we're at, where we have to. So if you're going to give these questionnaires in the schools, you have to have some kind of group process model. So it's not just collecting the data, it's what to do. That's why I said it had a 98% rate to show re-socialize. So you collect the data. Right. Okay, yes, we were traumatized. Then what? What are you going to do with this data? Dorothy Lewis did a lot of studies with offenders at Yale, and she said, you don't ask them, why did you do what you do anymore? You ask them, what happened to you? So you have to give people that outlet and give them a space to talk and to share so that some healing can take place. Because collecting the data, we all know there are certain issues in our society. And, you know, with what we will say is the cultural norm, we all know that. But what are we going to do about it in our lifetime?
So it's a part of a loving conversation of a group that's developing together. This is not, I will find out what happened with you. This is a part of how we talk to each other to bring about this healing that we are seeking to get.
And that's what your program is doing, Shivag. I follow you all the time. The whole point is Bahamians don't tell you their stuff until they know you. They can give you, they're very great talkers. That's why any research you're going to speak, ask somebody some questions, you don't know what you're doing. You have to have a relationship. And then when they trust you, when you ask them a question, they will tell you what's going on. Sometimes in the family, it takes 6 months before they even tell me what's going on. 6 months. You just have to wait. But they can talk. Oh, they can talk now. They can talk. They can send you down a rabbit trail, and you think you'd have a clue what's going on.
Nice.
Interesting people. Sidney Poitier was a great actor, but there are many Sidney Poitiers running around the streets of Nassau and Freeport. They're very good. And they can freak me out. They can always trick me. They can talk down to me. I trick myself.
Well, you psychiatrists say that most of us, when we meet people for the first time, we show them an image of ourselves. But the angel, we never show them the darkness that is us, all the totality that is us. So we put on a face.
That's right. That's
a face, a part of it, but also a part of it.
That's Bahamian. Hey, Ms. Archer, that's Bahamian.
Well, not just that. I mean, a part of it, we are good performance people. I think it's a skill we do have. But a part of it is, as you both stated at the beginning, this conversation or this epidemic is birthed out of shame, too. So you don't really want to approach something that you already know is shameful. And then something that could perhaps isolate people more, make people more ashamed. Even, you know, something as simple as, I know persons who was ashamed to stand up in the lunch line for the free lunch because they know their friends would know that their parents didn't have money to give them lunch. So something with violence and personal issues like that in the education system, it could make matters worse. But then, and then the other aspect of it as well is the sense in which it is normal. It may seem normal, like growing up, maybe in my generation, where, you know, the Bill Cosby show or other shows where you saw families in nonviolent, healthy relationships, you would think that that's just something on show. That's just like a cartoon that doesn't actually exist in a reality because your reality is so encapsulated or contained by violence that is actually the normal. So even writing something on a paper or completing a text, an assessment, you would write what, you know, is the cartoon version, because the normal is to keep that quiet or to keep that isolated. That's just the family's business, you know, and that's a way of life. That's not even trying to be a great pretender. That's just the culture.
This same book, The Body Keeps the Score, they make a point that they say that we may be treating today experiences that happened 50 years ago at an ever-increasing cost. So it's very costly to keep this shrouded in shame and secrecy. So how long are we going to spend now, or are we going to spend later? Because eventually we're going to treat it, because the people are going to present with physiological issues, psychological issues, or it's going to come out violence as a new form of communication.
And, you know, Dr. Allen, I heard you speak about guilt and shame before. And, you know, this country, this may be true in other countries, but I live here. So I'm talking about us. We use shame like a weapon. Like if we don't like you or we have an issue with you, when we find out something that may not be so good about you, we use that to bury you in this country. And so people, like to Leslie's point, people ain't gonna do everything in their power to keep their thing shush. Don't let nobody know what's going on and what have you. But I read that shame was actually a tool of a community for restoration initially. What it was, as it said, you violated our community standard. We now chastise you for having done so. But the big part of it was, we fully restore you if you mend your ways. And so now there was no lingering anything about what you did and what we found, because you now decided to mend your ways and so forth. But my observation here is that you got people who people are whispering about generations after a thing happened with a family member. Oh, that's the thing of them child. Them, their people, they daddy, da-da-da-da.
Dr. Talbot, you're very right. We're a shame-based society. I'm sorry to say that, but that's really true. And we know how to shame others. Shame the people, shame others. The only place they found it like us is in China. And I dealt with some family groups in China. And the whole point was how they shamed it. So one guy said, "Doc, I shamed my kids so bad, he became top of his class." But now he passed his exam. He's a professional, but he wouldn't speak to me. I said, "Sir, you got your answer, right? You shamed him so bad, he succeeded, but now you broke the relationship." They said, "You know, in China, we need to learn how to relate to each other." I said, "Even the Bahamas need to learn it too." Shame breaks relationships. It happens around the fourth month, shame. And as a result, as it goes on, it gets worse. Guilt takes place in the third and fourth year. So that for guilt, there has to be a cognitive structure. Guilt is, "I made a mistake." Shame is what? "I am the mistake."
The mistake.
Very important. And so in Adam and Eve, when God came down the quiet of the day and said, "Adam, where are you?" That's always a shame question. Where are you and what have you done? That's what he's asking us today. David Allen, where are you? What have you done? What's going on? Are you fulfilled? These are very heavy questions. Adam said, "We messed up. We're afraid. We disobeyed. And so we're naked. We're hiding some fig leaves." "But Adam, go away. We can't meet with you because we're shame and we're naked. We don't want to leave our fig trees." Shame always looks for some place to hide. "I could have killed myself a hole." That's why shame and mortification go together. So what Adam and Eve said, "Go away." In other words, they rejected the love they craved and walked toward the rejection they feared. Let me say it again. Shame is rejecting the love you crave and walking toward what? The rejection you fear. Thank God for Easter. God didn't give up on us. I think after that point, God went to Jesus and said, "Look, you better go down. These guys, they're so ashamed, they're rejecting the love they crave and walking toward the rejection they fear." W.H. Auden said he was beautiful. He said, "You know, it's interesting. We prefer to be ruined rather than changed. We prefer to die in our shame and dread than to climb the cross for a moment and let our stupid illusions die." So now, sometimes you prefer to die rather than face shame. This is important.
Yeah, very important.
Shame is more powerful than death.
Very important.
As an example, a lady was beaten so bad 3 years ago. They called me from another country. "Doc, you must find her." I finally found her, a very distinguished lady. Said, "Doc, I've got my will together. I told the guy, once you don't kill my children, you can kill me. My will is done. I'd like to have a beautiful funeral and it'll be all over." "And David Allen, don't you report this." I said, and 3 o'clock in the morning, the phone rang. My wife was happy. "No." She did this call where you can't get called back. And I know it's her calling me. The guy was outside. "Do you want me to tell me goodbye?" I found the place. She said, "Doc, leave me alone. I prefer to die than report this because I'll be shamed. Having a nice funeral is better than reporting this." "So you're telling this is stronger? Shame is stronger than death?" "Yes, Doc. I prefer to die. Just don't kill my children. I've got my will straight. Let me die." Finally, I got her into my program. She's now doing very well. But please hear me. Behemoth would prefer to die rather than face the shame.
In fact, I was going to tell you that in reading about shame, I was listening to a documentary about shame. It was the psychiatrist was saying that the key to overcoming the dread of shame is to give up the delusion of the false face that you keep trying to protect. Says you have to see, as long as you hold on to this thing you told people you are or pretended or may or people came to think you are, and you want to protect that, you can never overcome shame, because it's vulnerability that allows you to dissolve shame. The vulnerability that says, "This is me, all of me. The good, the bad, the ugly, all of me."
Shivago, what you're saying is very true. I've had a lady whose husband was unemployed for a year. He lost his job a whole year ago. Yet every morning he'd get dressed, put on his Old Spice and his clothes and drive his car to work. He didn't go to work for 1 year. He lost his job. She didn't know. And finally, when I met him, he said, "I was ashamed. I couldn't tell her." But I said, "Why didn't you find out?" "Well, I always trust my husband." "But 1 year, Shivago, he was ashamed. I couldn't tell her." And she played into the shame by saying, "Well, you know," so we play into the shame as well.
Yeah.
Is that sad? So there's some guys right now who are dying. You ask them how they're doing. "I'm fine, Dave, I'm fine. The wife is gone, the children are gone, Bozo the dog is gone. And they're still fine. And I'm blessed." What is that, Shivago? He said, "Help me, man. Help David, help me."
Is the answer bringing emotional intelligence in the school or emotional intelligence training?
Are you so intelligent? Miss Archie, you're so intelligent.
Or bringing it to ourselves. A lot of this is just a willingness to be courageously honest with yourself and other people, is it not? Because, which is emotional intelligence also, is you have to be courageously authentic and honest with yourself. Because sometimes people will ask me, how are you doing? I say, well, most things are good. Oh, no, you're a Christian. You said, no, most things. You're supposed to call those things. I said, listen to me. Most things are good. I have some stuff that crappy and I have to deal with them.
Yes, right. So, Father, we call it being known. Do you want to crack your shame barrier? You have to choose to be known. You have to choose to be known. If you want to keep your shame, you can't be known. The sad thing is that many Bahamians live and die and don't know who we were. Let me say it again. Many Bahamians live and die and don't know who they are. I can tell you, and Bahamians will come when they broke the shame core, and whole families will be seven women. Seven women as incested by the father. Seven. One got ready, still was trying to incest it while the husband was out. That's heavy. When I crack those kind of barriers, there's a connection become that it's stronger than death. Now, for the first time, they could be healed. You realize they couldn't look in the mirror, Shivago? They couldn't look in the mirror. I said, why? When you've been shamed and been obsessed, you can't look in the mirror, doctor. But they say, you're beautiful. No, I can't see it. That's how deep. But they go to work every day. They make money. They get married. But they keep the shame. They are not known. Hello, who's home? I don't know.
I think that's aligned to your point about having the courage to communicate. It has to go along with also having the tools and the skills to communicate, because you could have courage and then still not have the tools to be able to communicate in an effective or productive way. Like you struggle to either, if that's through language or if that's through some form of expression, this toolkit needs to be given and trained on how to use it to get.
That's a very good point, Ms. Archer. In the family, use role play, which is like psychodrama, because babies are great actors. Whenever a person incests it, I have somebody play the father, to play the victim, and the whole group goes crazy as they get into it. And then they say, oh, you too? Me too. I was incested as well. But in that cocoon of closest being known, the whole thing just develops deeper and deeper and deeper. Once you see that, it's so beautiful. We are beautiful people, Ms. Archer.
Ms. Bethel, sorry, you're going to...
Another tool too, because I have this as a PowerPoint, and the very last slide on my PowerPoint is, listen, people start to heal the moment they feel heard. Because when you listen, you start to look. And when you look, you learn. And when you learn, you start to love. So if you would just take the time to actually listen to people, like you said, they would ask you how you're doing, and they don't like the answer that you gave, but nobody's listening to see, they can ask, what are the things that aren't going so well? Are you whining? You have a minute, you want to talk about it. Like they just want a generic answer, yeah, I'm okay, and then move on from that. They want to check some boxes, say, oh, at least I check in with him today, or at least he can't say I wasn't checking, you know. But if you start to listen to people, then they will start to heal, and you will start to heal to hear what someone else is going through. So that can be a tool as well, Ms. Archer, if we just learn to listen more as a people and talk less.
We've got to take our final break, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Z Live. I'm Shivago Lang, your host. I'm here with Dr. David Allen, Keva Bethel, and also with Mrs. Leslie Archer. We're talking about violence in this country, and we're not only talking about violence, but we're talking about how we can work through some of this, the effects of this violence, and probably undo it. We're going to take our final break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation.
Have you taken a look at those investment options yet?
Too busy. Look at today. Workout, breakfast, drop kids at school, back-to-back meetings, dog from the groomer, nails, and that's all before 12. How come you're so chill?
That's because my money is as busy as you.
At RF, we find the best Bahamian and international investments to keep your money busy so you can spend more time focusing on you. Contact us at rfgroup.com to find out more. RF, money at work.
Every Thursday until April 6th between 5 and 6 p.m. is Come Gold With Us Thursdays. Follow us and like our Facebook page, 50th Carifta 2023. Then keep a lookout for our team and get a chance to win a golden ticket and many, many more giveaways for the 50th Carifta Games 2023. For more details, email info@carifta50.com or call 808-GOLD.
Wednesdays just got a whole lot better. Introducing Whopper Wednesdays at Burger King Nassau. Get a flame-grilled Whopper for only $5.50, including VAT. Yes, you heard that right. This Wednesday, you can indulge in the classic flame-grilled Whopper you love, made your way for only $5.50. Stop by your favorite Burger King Nassau location this Wednesday and enjoy a Whopper for only $5.50. Burger King Nassau, where taste is king.
Shopping is so rewarding with my Fidelity credit card. I get the best prices with price protection. Earn and redeem freedom points at my favorite stores. Get cash back. Plus, I booked a cruise. Get your Fidelity credit card today. Call 356-7764.
You see how Cora eye look funny, all black up yesterday?
But she say she bump into a wall when she's running after the churn them.
Yeah, but last Saturday, you see her arm was all black and blue, right?
What you saying? You think something wrong between her and Jack?
I ain't sure, but you know Jack is a jealous man. I hear him and Cora last Friday. I hear him say he hear Cora have eyes for Junior.
Now, you know that ain't true. Cora is a good woman. Does mind her business, take care of them churn, and go to church every Sunday. So what you think we should do?
I think we should report Jack, you know. Cora don't say nothing, but silence hides violence. And we don't want to line up in the cemetery.
Not me. I ain't getting in nobody business. Then Jack come after me and I land up next to Cora.
No, man, we could call a text Crime Stopper. And remember, we can even get some grocery money for our tip.
Remind me again how this work.
We can call them in Miami at 328-TIPS or 328-8477. Or when we in the island, call toll-free at 300-TIPS or 300-8477. And if you don't have no minutes, use the Crack Crime Bahamas app and we could text them and the messages get on mix-up before it leave your phone so nobody can know what you're saying.
So what are we waiting on then? Let's go earn some grocery money.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
I'm not afraid, I'm not afraid to take a stand, take a stand. Everybody, everybody, come take my hand, come take my hand. We'll walk this road together through the storm, whatever weather.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Z Live. I'm Shivago Lang. So glad that you could join us here today on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM on this Policy Wednesday, where we are having a conversation with Dr. David Allen, Kevin Bethel, Mrs. Leslie Archer from the Government and Public Policy Institute on the issue of violence. In fact, the tunnel of violence in our country, learning lots of important things about causes and remedy to some of the violence that we are experiencing in the country. And I want to extend an invitation to yourselves, Dr. Allen, because I use the show for educational purposes. That's what I try to do. I try to inform people. I could be involved with the sensational. I could be involved with the that stuff, but that's not really what I'm interested in. But any day, even if you want to do it on a regular basis, any day you want to come and let's have this continuing conversation that might help our community help itself heal from some of this trauma, you have an open invitation on Z Live to do so. You and anyone else you want to bring. Because I believe that this continuing conversation is important. Do it on one show. We'll get some things done, but maybe we'll get some more done. If we use your show that you do on my show and then other people's show, the more we get the word out and the more we form a relationship with people. Because, I have a lady who texted me and said, Mr. Lang, every day, me and my husband, we get up and sit on our sofa and we listen to the show. So that's
they're
like family.
Enjoy you as well.
Thank you, sir. It's like a family, you know. So if you're interested, please let me know anytime, and let's have this conversation.
We're talking about the Parliament. I always like your shows on the Parliament, how it works, and you give me hope.
Thank you. All a part of trying to help people understand, because Leslie said it, and it's true. And so did Kevin. When you know how to do something, it makes it easier to do it, right? If you pick up a skill, if you understand it and you know what to do, then you can apply that in the environment you're in. Now, let me tell you what I have discovered from my own personal experience. I know how to do many things, but learning how to deal with my emotions, learning how to deal with my mind, was and is one of the hardest things I've ever tried to do in my life. It is really, because no one, it wasn't something that you were taught. So you have anger inside of you. You have frustration. You have, it took me till I was 54 years old to realize that anger is rooted in hurt, that sadness is rooted in loss. So when I got angry, when I got sad, I had to figure out what did I lose that was making me sad? What hurt me that was making me angry? But I didn't know that before I was 54 years old. I did not.
I did a suicide study, and what I found was a lot of the victims, it covered suicide in the Bahamas from 2000 to 2013. And a lot of the victims were young adult males. And we can argue, is that the age when there's a shame gap between expectations and reality? What is society telling us by mid-30s, 40s, maybe even 50, we should be and where we actually are? And, how powerful is our culture to dictate where somebody should be that they feel less than?
Absolutely.
Very good, Kevin.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing, and as you said, but the thing is, the expectations are very well known. This is how a man acts. This is how a woman acts. This is how you should be if you're a lawyer. This is how you should be if you're a doctor. Well, if you are drunk, this is what I expect. So the expectations are really well known. What is not so well known is, what do you do if you don't meet these expectations? Sometimes, what do you do if you meet them and you don't feel the way you thought you should have felt when you did? Because now you're grappling with this. Man, I'm a lawyer. I'm making money. I got a nice fancy house. I got a nice wife, my children. I got a nice car. People think I'm somebody, but inside of me, I just feel like crap. And I don't know why. I don't understand why. And there's no, and many of us have gotten no tools to deal with that internal process.
Very, very important. Very important.
And that's what you said, Dr. Allen, that a lot of people are walking around. I'm assuming that the answer is really identity. Who am I? And you have to really find the peace and everything you need in the intangible identity rather than the tangible externalities. And there are a lot of people that come, live, die and don't know the answer to that question. Who am I? What am I doing really? Like, why am I here really? That affects everyone. That's like a universal question of life, I think. I would venture to say.
Yeah. My
and
son.
The biggest lies are the ones we tell ourselves. That's where the shame comes in. The biggest lies are the ones we tell ourselves. So it's not what society is also telling us that we internalize, but then you feel some type of way because you're not meeting. So you're lying to yourself saying, this is where I should be. This is where I am. And that plays a huge, because between 2000 and 2013, we had 96 suicides, So that was a big deal, all because of the shame gap, the expectation, the reality, the lies, and then broken dreams, broken hearts.
Yeah. It's a interesting web. that we have to work through. But it's life. I mean, and Dr. Allen said it earlier, he's hopeful. There's many good reasons to be hopeful when you interact with many are young Bahamians. When you interact with not so young Bahamians, you see their grace, you see their gentleness, you see their love and compassion. You see their willingness to help, their attempts to help, their interest in helping, the extent to which they take in other people's children, trying to rescue where they see things failing. That is happening in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. So we have these distresses, but we also have these communities of hope where people are trying to do, whether they're educators and otherwise, like yourself, trying to make it better.
Trying and succeeding.
Shivago, Kamala, is very true what you said. There's so much good happening in the Bahamas. We're a beautiful country, but we have a silo effect. We don't let other people know what we're doing. Mm. We don't communicate. We don't connect. But there's so many good things happening. Some kids are being seen by 4 or 5, the church, an educational program, a police program, the defense force program. There's no communication between the programs. You can't help a child unless there's communication. Mm. You have to destroy the silo effect. But the silo effect is just what? The shame effect, the shame gap. I can't let you know what I'm doing because you may steal my files. So what? All my papers, we send them out. Give them to people. Teach everything I told you. It's already written. It's fine. It's beautiful. It's not mine. It's ours. It's ours. We have a whole room filled with this research. People come from all over the world looking for the research. I can't get Bahamians interested in it yet. But we have people that have PhDs on this work. It's gone to China. It's gone to Russia. But a lot of Bahamians say, Doc, I don't need to read the book. You know, well, hi, I can talk to you. Yeah, that's good. Why should I buy your book and I could talk? Yeah, I agree. Yeah. That's what America is so far. But we have a way of, we don't like each other sometimes, and that's the shame gap again. So we have this silo. I can't let you know what I'm doing. But if we all do, let's come together. It's okay. That's where the hope is.
You know, the parable of the sower, I when I share about it, I ask people, how much do you know about the sower? What was his name? How old was he? Or it may have been a she. Who knows? But what do you know? You don't know much about the sower. I said, how much do you know about the seed? Was it corn? Was it this? Was it that? You know nothing. The most detail you have in that is about the soil, what the thing that receives. I said, why do you think that is? I said, because when you are a sower and you are sowing good things, you can be indiscriminate about it. You would think that a sower would have been more careful. Let me test the soil. Let me check to make sure this could receive it. That wasn't the case. This was good stuff. You throw it everywhere. And so to your point, if you have good things, you know, keeping it to yourself benefits no one. But if you share it and be liberal about the sharing, then chances are you get to benefit even that much more people.
Shivago, what you're saying is very true. I can't be discouraged. On Saturdays, 12:32, come to an NPCC on Blake Road. 30, 40 people. What are they doing? Just trying to know themselves. Camp Road on a Monday night, the teenage program. So the more I get going, the more I see to do. It's so beautiful. We're a beautiful country. But shame, self-hatred aimed at me. We got to like each other. And the first person you need to like is yourself. Come home to you and know yourself for the first time. You know that song, I've been to Nassau, been to Paris, been to New York, but I've never
been to me. Yeah, and that's Leslie pointed out, that's one of the great challenges. Who am I? I was talking to my son the other day. By the way, I have a listener who tells me I talk about my family too much. I tell him a lot, that's the one I could relate to, right? That's the thing I know. But I was talking to him and I asked him, I said, what's a man to you? He said, like a father. I said, no, that's a role. So he said, a husband. I said, that's a role. I said, you know, every man starts first as a person. And that's what you are first. You are a person, separate and apart from anything. You're not my son first. You're a person first, a living person, self-aware person. And I said, that's the person you want to become most aware about and most comfortable with, because that person you could share with other people. And I couldn't have had that. I didn't have that conversation early in life, but the reality is as Leslie said, we never get confronted with that question. Who are you really outside of the roles that you play in the society? Because where the shame comes is when we fail the role.
It's sad, you know, because shame is the block between your essential you and the you you are. Why can't we get to know ourselves, Shafago, and hold ourselves and say, welcome home, David. Welcome home, Keva. Why are we afraid of getting to know us?
We have about 2 minutes left, Keva. First, let me ask you if you wanted to leave us with any notes before we depart.
I would just say, you know, this is Holy Week. I would just say to be mindful. Be mindful of the way we speak to each other. Be mindful of how we treat ourselves and each other. Because, you know, the words you say to other, you don't know what hurt they're carrying from. Remember the evil violence tunnel? He was carrying that hurt from a little child. And your words may just further push him into the tunnel to harm himself or herself or harm others. So just be careful of the way that we treat, we treat each other. And finally, what I would like to leave with you is Dr. Bessel van der Kolk said, the same capacity we take to destroy one another is the same capacity we can take to heal one another.
Beautiful.
Dr. Allen?
Well, you know, it's Easter, he's risen. If somebody said, if he really is risen, the rest is rock and roll. Let's go. The party of life has begun. It's okay now. We can live and we can what? Die. It's all hope. And we live in a beautiful country. It's 79 years old. All I see is beauty and hope beyond. Let's keep going.
Thank you so very much. Leslie, you get the last word.
And if you want full access to the study, I would say that you can just message Mr. Lang, they can hit you up, right? You can also send an email to GPPI, G for government, P for public policy institute, GPPI@UB, for the University of the Bahamas, .edu, short of education, .com, right? GPPI@UB.edu.BS.
BS, .com, yeah.
BS.
.BS, yeah.
And I can give you access to the complete study, The Tunnel of Violence, and which is the work done by Keva Bethel and David Allen.
Thank you very much, folks. Really appreciate y'all. Ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Z Live. Thank you very much.
Recording stopped.
Barbara Lang, your host. So glad you could join us today. God spares life. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Have a great, great evening.
Okay. Okay, bye. Okay. Everybody.